This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by Casper.com. Go to Casper.com and use offer code FAMILYHOUR to get $50 off your first order. If you've been dreaming about a headless dog with wasp stingers for nipples, it's probably because your old mattress is covered with tears and jizz. Go to Casper.com. Get a new mattress. Now! Hello, my dear, sweet friends. It is I, Duncan Trussell, and I'm ashamed to start this podcast off with yet another audio apology. But I got to apologize, and I understand that apologizing too much is a sign of weakness. I know the history of the world. I know that in the medieval times, it was a common practice to drag on Sundays the apologizers of the village into the town square and yank their pants down, exposing their pasty medieval buttocks, and to spend hours flogging them with branches and leather straps until rivulets of medieval plague blood dribbled down into their lice-encrusted leg hair. Wolves would be released from the pens surrounding the town square, and the wolves would run to the buttocks and lap at the briny medieval blood, licking and licking and sometimes chewing. And the screams of the apologizers would rise up into the forest canopy, and cursed owls would fly to the homes of witches and lay devil eggs into the witches' chalices, which the witches would then use to make the cows of the village stop producing milk and the babies deformed. I get it. I don't mean to be the apologizing person, but I have to. And this is it. I look at this, what happened today, in this episode, as a sign from the podcasting gods that it is time for me to move on. I will admit that this particular problem, this issue, which is that when I was recording this podcast, I did not realize that I was recording not into my wonderful, fancy Shure microphones that are running into a fancy, some fancy other shit, which I don't know the name of, really, because I'm not an audio engineer. But rather, what happened was that I recorded this entire podcast into the onboard mic of my laptop. I want to blame it on the house. I want to blame it on the room that the podcast studio is stationed in, this ancient house that is essentially in the middle of a concrete kennel. I'm surrounded by dogs on all sides, hundreds and thousands of baying, flea-covered Los Angeles mongrels rolling in the dust, chasing the emaciated drought squirrels that sometimes fall out of the tree because they're dehydrated. I want to blame it on the fact that sometimes it feels as though the walls of the podcast studio are cursed, that behind the walls of the podcast studio are the obsidian carapaces of demonic mantis creatures that emanate a shit heat that fills up the podcast studio. I want to blame it on the sun and whatever terrible confluence of bad circumstance and environmental disaster has created the super hot conditions of Los Angeles, but the real blame has got to go to my right hand, which 2 hours prior to this podcast, in front of my own eyes, scooped a large quantity of caramel cannabis-infused marijuana. Like a monkey scooping at banana cream, I watched it happen, fast, quick. Before I could do anything, my hand lifted the sweet THC-infused sugary mass into my mouth, and my mouth betrayed me by chewing it and swallowing it, getting it into my stomach. And the betrayal continued as my stomach removed the THC from the caramel and via my circulatory system got that THC into the neuroreceptors of my brain, causing me to experience a state of marijuana intoxication. This was mixed in with alpha brain, and the combination of these two things put me in a warm, mellow, happy, focused state. And yet, because I was so comfortable emotionally, I didn't pay attention to the fact that regardless of how many times I turned the dial on my mixing board, the waveform on the audio program I used to record was not changing. I decided, oh, I'm sure it's fine. Why would the waveform change if I adjust the volume levels? And as a neophyte, lazy stoner audio engineer, what ended up happening is I recorded what I consider to be a great podcast where Tate told me things that I'm going to think about for a very long time to come. And yet the sound quality is degraded and diminished. And so you're going to hear clicks, the clicking of the chairs on the wooden floor. The odds are also good that you're going to hear droplets of sweat rolling down my esteemed guest's face and landing onto my podcast table. And you've got to understand how awful that is to have my friends drive through LA traffic, which is what Tate did, to come into a podcast studio where they experience what it must be to be one of those fat little hot dogs rolling in one of those stinky 7-Eleven hot dog distribution machines. It makes me feel terrible to look across at my guest as they're overheating because they're in a room in a 100-year-old house in the middle of a kennel that also seems to be on the flight path of the Los Angeles Police Department's helicopter division. And they're sweating. They're like crawfish in a boil pot. I feel like I'm staring at So it honestly is like watching someone in the last stages of their life. No one in the history of interviewing ever said, if you want to get a great interview, put your guests in a superheated room and surround them with howling, baying dogs in the flight path of militarized helicopters. So I got to move. I just don't want to do the podcast in an office space. I feel like there's something cool about folks coming over to your house. It makes it more intimate. In the meantime, pray for me. Pray to all the angels in heaven and hell, whatever particular deity you happen to worship. If you don't worship a deity, pray to the laws of logic and mathematics. Pray to whatever super consistent, transcendent force you consider to be the place from which the universe emerges from. And I guess I'd try to keep my hand from shoving marijuana-infused cannabis treats into my mouth before I do a podcast, but that would be the same thing as me saying I was going to stop doing podcasts, which I don't plan on doing for a very, very long time. Thank you guys for bearing with me. I hope that you will make it through this podcast, even though the audio quality is incredibly low grade. It's well worth it. Tate really blasts out some serious hardcore truth bombs, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. He's a super cool guy, a fighter, an actor, an entrepreneur, and just and he's one of the sweetest guys I know, and yet he lives inside a very menacing, dangerous-looking physical form, which is pretty cool. So we're going to jump right into that interview, but first, let's do some quick business. Today's episode of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast is brought to you by the Dream Lords over at Casper.com. Use offer code FAMILYHOUR and you will receive $50 off a sweet mattress. Some time ago in 2013, I was hornswoggled by a mattress monger in a mattress depot in Atwater Village. I went in there, I was grieving and sad. I had recently lost a mother and a testicle, and I was in a complete confused state of feverish lunacy where I thought the way to cure the aching, empty horror inside of me that was coming from the grim realization that me and everyone I know will eventually die was to buy a hyper-expensive mattress that could vibrate. I ended up buying this thing, walking out of the mattress store, holding a pink invoice slip with the terrible numbers indicating how much I had paid for this shit mattress, haunting me as I got in the car. But because I was out of my mind with grief and post-cancer sickness, I was excited. I didn't know that I'd been ripped off. I actually looked forward to the delivery of this dark hell pad that came to my house. And before long, I realized that the cure for the first noble truth of Buddhism, life is suffering, was not to buy a new mattress and lay on it pretending that everything was okay. This mattress was embarrassing. It vibrated. There's nothing good about having a vibrating bed. The only people who like vibrating beds are serial killers and whoremongers. It was embarrassing. I actually showed it off to my friends like it was a good thing. I paid so much money for this thing, I'm never going to say how much I paid, but it's humiliating the amount. Within 6 months, this mattress became soaked with my grief sweat and grief ejaculations until it looked like some satanic shroud of Turin, not showing the visage of our sweet Savior Lord Jesus Christ, but showing a map of every time I had ejaculated or sprayed fluid since I'd owned that mattress. And to compound the horror of this terrible mattress, it started sinking in, where I would lay for hours and hours in a feverish, depressed state. That place became hollowed out like a dark valley. And it was an embarrassment. And I realized I'd been ripped off. Fortunately, somewhere a few years after buying this thing, I was contacted by Casper Mattress, who said that they might be interested in advertising on my podcast. And I told them I had to try one out before I could advertise it. They sent me a mattress. This box comes. You cut it open. This beautiful mattress explodes out of the box. I replaced my super expensive, sad, semen-soaked doom mattress with this wonderful new Casper mattress, and I sleep on it to this very day. If that's not a great endorsement for a product, I don't know what is. It's fantastic. It's firm. It's bouncy. It's way better than the super expensive thing that I bought. I would not lead you astray. If you're thinking about getting a new mattress, or you're sleeping on a shitty mattress, or you understand a law of physics that has been proven by every single branch of science, which is that good dreams, they go up to heaven. Bad dreams, they come out of your brain and they sink into your mattress like seeds in a field. And the bad dreams will grow bad dream trees. If you're assuaged by bad dreams, if your marriage is a little wonky, if your kids seem dumb, if your complexion is too pallid, if your nipples are hanging, if your moobs are enlarged, if you notice that when you stare at your nipples in the mirror that there appear to be tiny little eyeballs staring out, these are all signs that can point in the direction that you may need a new mattress. Casper.com is the answer for you, my friends. Go to Casper.com, use offer code FAMILYHOUR. You will get $50 off your order for these mattresses. They start at $750, and they don't go that much up from there. That's for, you can get a queen. I don't know why you want to get a full-size bed, you freaking weirdo. Get a California king. That's where I screwed up. I didn't get a king. I got a queen. But I sleep on this mattress to this day. They're wonderful. Highly recommend them. And the great thing is, if you don't like the mattress, then you get around 3 months to try it out and you can actually send it back. So it's risk-free. Then you can go into one of these mattress mazes and get hoodwinked by one of these sons of bitches who sell shitty mattresses to America. Go to Casper.com, use offer code FAMILYHOUR, try one of these things out. I sleep on one. What else can I say? I sleep on a Casper mattress. It's great. I love it. It has yet to sink in, hollow out. It hasn't become like the discarded tampon of a malarial giant, which is what old mattresses that suck turn into. It's maintained its sweet, firm, wonderful quality. Thanks to all of you who continue to use our Amazon portal. I don't mean to be a fearmonger here, but I'm sure you've heard that gigantic trapdoor spiders have started burrowing underneath the floor of many local chain grocery stores and electronics depots, which means that the next time you go shopping, there is some 20 to 30% chance that the tile floor is going to open up faster than the human eye can see in a scaled, armored, hairy arachnid thing could yank you underneath the store and slowly devour you over the course of several years. I wouldn't take that risk. And aside from that, if you really want the experience of shopping at one of these chain stores, why don't you just fill a plastic bag up with your grandmother's farts and breathe into it as you shop on Amazon from the safety and comfort of your own home? Just go through the portal located at duncantrussell.com and they give us a percentage of anything that you buy. What have I recently ordered from Amazon? Well, I'll tell you, a comic book on communism, which I actually pathetically have yet to finish. There's still 15 pages or so to go. So go to Amazon today, but go through our portal. And a huge thanks to all of you who have been donating. This is definitely not a necessary thing to do, and if you decide to do it, I am extremely grateful. Some folks out there have actually set up a monthly donation plan, which is incredibly sweet of you. If you don't feel like just throwing money in the direction of a podcast, we got an awesome shop with a lot of cool t-shirts, festival banners, mugs, and stickers. I just want to read this email I got from somebody who wore one of our shirts to a music festival. Dear Duncan, I'll save you most of the details, but I just want to let you know that at the Down Under Deep Dish Music Festival in Lower Minnesota, I was approached by the most beautiful girl I'd ever seen in my life. Eyes as blue as eggs laid from the ass of a Braxis, hands soft and wide, lips like jellyfish bladders. She took me to her tent and we made love for 5 hours until protoplasmic tendrils that I was not aware that my body could even produce began extending from every part of my body, wrapping around her until her and I fused into one glorious sinewy ball of ecstatic bliss. We came so many times that the sound of our orgasms overpowered the sounds of the DJs, and the festival goers tore down our tents and devoured us, and we are now part of their consciousness, minds, and bodies forever. Yes, I am emailing to you from the astral plane, for I have fused with an entire music festival, all thanks to your reasonably priced, beautiful Ron Rigi Enneagram shirts, which are located at your shop. I sure hope people will go buy some today. Love, Moon Willow. You got it, Moon Willow. I know they're powerful shirts, and I really appreciate the email. Go check out the shop, guys. Get one of these, or gals, get one of these shirts. You never know what can happen. Also, and finally, I'm going on a big tour of Australia. That's in November. These tickets are moving faster than any other tickets that I've ever sold for any other tour, so I hope you'll consider getting those tickets in advance. I'm also going to be at the Laughing Skull in Atlanta in October. All right, that's it. Thanks for bearing with me. I love you guys. Today's guest is an actor, stuntman, fighter, and all-around badass entrepreneur. You can find out everything you need to know about him by going to TateGFletcher.com. Other links to reach him will be located at DuncanTrussell.com. Everybody, please welcome to the DTFH, Tate Fletcher. Tate Fletcher, welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Art Podcast. Hare Krishna, I'm so glad you're here.
Me too. So exciting, man.
It's very exciting to me too, because you just did something I consider to be heroic, which is you came through LA traffic to get here.
It's a thing that it wasn't easy, but when you get dedicated to a result, you know, there are no obstacles. There's just little occurrences you're going to have to surmount in this life to get to the place where you need to go.
Now, how often does that philosophy help you when you want to rip somebody's fucking head off in LA traffic?
You know, I did just offer, it's strange that you say that. I did offer an invitation to two young gentlemen that were in a Prius. They had cut off a bunch of people, and then they were on the side shoulder of the exit and trying to push in on everybody. And then I backed off and let them in, and then they're yelling to me. I was the guy that let them in. And I tried to wave them in, and they were like, what? And I was like, come on, you guys should just follow me. I'm going to take you to a great party. And they followed for a while, and I just rolled the window down and just smiled. They got up on both sides of the car, and I was like, come on, guys, really? And then they just kept driving straight. when I got off. But that does happen. But I feel like, you know, if you're invited to a party, you got to just accept whatever happens.
Yeah, I think I know what you're saying. You're saying that you were going to murder those two gentlemen.
You don't know what's going to happen when you get out of the car. But I want to avail myself to the experience. I'm an experiential guy. And so, you know, it's just like...
You don't know what's going to happen when you get out.
I feel like I have a lot of party favors with which to offer my guests. However...
You're a menacing guy. But you're a very nice guy. But let's just break it down.
Okay.
Man. You have fought.
Yes.
You're a fighter. You still fight.
Haven't fought in a long time, but yeah, I did. That was. I was still competing.
Right. You have been a competitive fighter
since 2000. About.
Yeah, and you now have transformed into an actor.
Yeah, yeah.
You were on Breaking Bad.
A really fortunate list of things.
And I keep seeing you in movies because whenever I'm watching, and you're in good movies too. Like
that's what I say is fortunate, because I look at friends of mine that have good resumes, and I'm like, God, I've never heard of that show that they were in, or I've never heard of that one, and it's like. Like, I've got a bunch of Marvel movies and you know, Lone Ranger. Like, there's a bunch of really good stuff there. You know, The Equalizer, John Wick, and things like that. And so, I've been super fortunate.
Yeah, and it's really, like, incredible to think of the weird life you've had, man. You've had an odd life, haven't you?
Well, I was thinking about it. Because you were like many lifetimes, right?
Many lifetimes. But, like, where were you born?
Michigan, Alpena, Michigan, up on the shore of Lake Huron.
And didn't you kind of become a criminal a little bit?
A criminal for like maybe from the gate, like for like, I mean, since I was like 11 or 12, since I first started exploring other people's homes when they weren't home.
Exploring. You weren't planning on robbing them, you were just exploring?
No, I was. I mean, we were looking for booze at that age. Like we would go and steal booze from people's houses, and then it just escalated as... You know, time grew on and opportunities came up and all that.
How old were you when you were doing that?
A kid, man. Like, you know, until I was maybe my last entry into a house unwanted was when I was 17 or 18, I guess.
Hold on.
So, yeah.
How do you make that decision for the first time?
I mean, it's exciting. You know, I've always been attracted to exciting, kind of adrenaline infused. Activities, no matter how scary they were, I like doing it. I think I just read a book recently called The Rise of Superman, which is a fantastic book. But he talks about it, and there's a bunch of stunt guys that did a jump, I believe it was for one of the Transformer movies. They jumped off the Sears Tower, and there's like five guys, and they jumped in unison. I don't know if you saw the movie, but they're in wingsuits. And so air, wind is really funny, especially in Chicago through buildings. Like if you're in a city, if you're in a canyon, you can count on it. To be a certain
right.
way, but it shifts and changes drastically and quickly in buildings. And so they jumped off and you know, they didn't know if they were going to die or not or what was going to happen. And they had to follow so closely to each other that they had to have telekinesis really of knowing before they couldn't, if they were going to make a 90 degree turn, by the time they saw your foot twitch to show that you were going to turn, it would be too late.
Wow.
They had to know 4 seconds before you were going to turn. So they have, and there's five guys doing this. They all have to forecast each other. And it's pretty phenomenal. But he said, you know, when people call us adrenaline junkies, it's not really what it is. Because, like, for me as a fighter and, like, all that, and I heard Brendan Schaub talked about it and described it beautifully. Like, most of those guys that are in the sport are, like, nervous, scared. They have a lot of emotions, ups and downs, and excited, everything, before they fight. But, you know, the thing is you're not after that adrenaline. You're after that flow state that happens that ensues afterwards. And you have to trigger it by doing something terrifying.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So you go into that thing and then norepinephrine comes in and adrenaline comes in and oxytocin comes in. And you begin to mutate time and shorten it. And you can distill it. And time slows down. You know, you get into a mutation. And the book goes into all of it beautifully. And it really gave an explanation for things that I'd always felt that I was... always drawn to and like why I was and I thought, well, what a misnomer that adrenaline junkie kind of thing is in a way, because nobody likes that. That's a kind of a terrifying
wow
experience,
yeah
right?
Yeah, you're more into you're a dopamine.
Right.
You're trying to squeeze that sweetness out of the synaptic vesicles, and the way you do it is by some kind of incredibly dangerous thing. But you're saying when you were breaking into houses, it was more for that state afterwards.
Totally for that when I was a kid. Ever since I was little, I was into that, like for forever. And so I love to throw snowballs at cars when I'm a little kid and then people chase you. Like, I love all that.
Right.
Like, all the cops and robbers stuff, and it just grew into my life. And then also, I made a living that way for a while. I mean, just selling dope and
did you ever get in trouble?
Yeah, locked up a couple times. The last significant thing was a big charge, but, and then I got acquitted of that, and then that was the last time, and that was when I was in my early 20s, and I really was like, my life's got to change, I've got to have a shift in my life, and so I did, and that's when I started jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu really kind of saved my life in a lot of ways, and helped me come for myself.
Before we get to that, how long were you in jail?
For that last charge?
If this is okay to talk about, by the way.
It's a long time ago. I waited, I don't know. Maybe that time before, like, I did two court sentences and I was there maybe a month and a half or something before I was released. And then I got cleared and off paper like 6 months later or something. There was a guy I was with and there's a bank that got robbed and all of that kind of thing. And so he had to cop to it and be tried and sentenced.
There's a bank that got robbed.
Yeah.
By who?
This guy that I was a buddy with.
Okay, but you...
all my friends, you know.
Okay, I see. So you are like, you're living like the Grand Theft Auto life.
Not quite like that, but it had its colorful moments, you know.
Can you give me an example?
It's just like, it's more desperate than that. I mean, it's more like, it's not like everybody's just a gorilla in the streets. I mean, it looks like that, but it's like, you're hidden, you know. I remember when I heard the first time I heard like a Dr. Dre album and I was like, they're freely talking about this. Because like that's your life. And you're like, I know people that have fucking done horrific things to people and they're not writing a song about it. I'm like, these guys are all fake. Like this is, or something. Like I didn't really get it, but like when you're selling dope, you're not singing songs about selling dope. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so then, you know, the thing is just like, how am I getting through day to day? Like really, you know, we're all kind of, you know, there's a group of us and we're all like really into drugs and into booze and like in that lifestyle. And Michigan's kind of a poor place it's like maybe the second or third poorest place in the world. I think my hometown was up to like 24% unemployment a couple years ago. And then those people drop off unemployment and then they're just still unemployed. They just aren't, you can't count them as a number anymore because they're now just poor. So there wasn't a lot of choices. Like my family was a nice family. They did great. But the whole surroundings is poverty, you know? And so you can go on the merchant marine boats, you can join the army, you can be a criminal. And that's kind of your choices in a way. Or you can go and try to work at a flower shop or this or that, but there's not a whole lot. You know, the United Auto Workers at that time were doing well for a little bit, but then even then they were cutting their pensions to zero. And that's kind of, you're in that kind of a thing, you know, where like, when I was a little boy, like Flint was huge. Like it blown up with General Motors. And it was one of the biggest cities in Michigan. And it's like a ghost town. Like there's, when those jobs go away, you've just made a huge slum is what you've done. And so it's kind of like, you know, people are like, there's bad areas. You know, like in LA, you go, what's a bad area? It's like, you kind of get got anywhere here. Like it's kind of like that. But like there's places in Michigan where it's kind of like, these are vacuous holes that you just don't, there's no reason to be there. And so it's, you know, but that, you know.
That's a crazy place to grow up, man.
Life's kind of what you make of it too, you know what I mean? Well, and it's like where you want to go with it and what you need to escape from.
I'm interested in what is going through your mind on the fifth day of a month-long prison sentence.
Oh man, I'm with five Mexican dudes in a fucking cell. And they're not speaking any English, and it's scary, you know. I'm a young guy, and in the U.S. Marshal's office, and you know, while we're in holding, like everybody just got picked up, and there's a bunch of guys with recidivism that have just, you know, their parole officers have just put them back, and guys talking about the whole thing, you know, and fucking rape you later tonight. And
so that's real.
All of that.
That's real.
The dude that one of the guys that was sent that said that to me, this old shitty white trash biker, and he goes, he got the way he violated his parole is his parole. He didn't check in. Like, how hard is that? You just go check in.
Right.
And he didn't go check in, and he's out at this farmhouse, and he's got a guy that I don't know if he thought snitched on him or what happened, who's hanging in his barn, who he's skinning, who's alive. He's in the process of taking it. Like, and I don't know if that's real or not. That's what they're saying. Like, yeah, that's how he violated. So there's these kinds of people that I'm with. Then there's the guys that the in Colorado Springs, they were called, this is up in Colorado, they called it Compton Springs, and they just got these nine dudes, they just got in a shootout with the ATF and shot a couple guys in the face, and like there's all, and they're happy as fuck. They were stoked. It's like they'd made it. They're in federal prison. And
really?
Yeah, it was crazy.
Why? Because federal prison's better somehow?
No, I mean, just because they'd gotten a big, it's like there's a sense with some guys like that they're made if they get into a spot like that, right?
That's nuts. Anywhere.
I mean, and you know, it's the same thing you see. I see guys like that get out after they've done 5 or 6 years and they come back to a neighborhood. It's like if you go, you know, Abbot Kinney or something like that was like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, right? It's like you're not like, you don't want your lady to walk around there after dark or whatever. It's not safe. And now it's like mini skirts and high heels at 10 at night, and it's no big deal. And so imagine you go and you're a gangbanger and you go away for that time and come back. It's like, I totally understand the idea about you would be a chronic recidivist because you're in a way not welcome back into your community where you used to be something. Everything's changed. You're not shit. Fuck off. And you are somebody in prison. And a lot of those guys find that there. I think they find a status or a caste system that they can understand.
But man, there you are.
There I am.
And you're like, an intelligent guy.
I don't know when I'm going to leave. I don't know any of that stuff. And I've been called for court before. We got called on the day that I got released.
But I'm just trying to think, like, how are you rationalizing your life?
At the moment. You're not thinking of that. For me, and then there was a riot right when I got there. And so everybody's fucked up. Like, it's crazy. And so I'd never been in any situation like that before, and I didn't know really how to take it. So you just kind of stay close. Even people that are nice to you, you're even more careful around them. And, you know, keep your back to the wall. And it's really, you know, the blacks are hanging out with the blacks and the whites are hanging out with the whites. And there was this guy, Walker Knight. He befriended me. He's this big, tall black dude. And he was super dope, man. And then he's like, hey, dude, this is the guy that you need to hook up with when you get inside. Like, because when we were all picked up by the FBI and then we're in the U.S. Marshal's office for a couple of days and we get put in Inglewood and you know, he kind of made introduction to make it like an easier way. And I don't know how that all would have played out had I been there a long time. Like, I don't know a lot about it. It's not like I spent months and years there, but it's crazy. It's a different world, man. It's a different world. And you're moment to moment. Everybody says that, though, Duncan. They go, how'd you survive this in your life? How'd you survive that in your life? And it's like, you don't think that way. All you think is like, I've got one foot in front of the other, and I'm just aware. And you get hyper aware, right? You get hyper aware, and you're just moving through time and space. You don't reflect on it and be like, how am I going to get through this? It's just like, it is happening so rapidly.
Right.
That you better be in it. And it became like, that was the first time that I did a stick fight. That really dawned on me and kind of coalesced and distilled into that of like, you need to be hyper present in your life all the time. And this was like a couple years later. That I had that opportunity, but I'm like, when a stick is swinging by your head, you're either awake and aware and conscious all the time, or you're unconscious because you've gotten clunked, you know? And that becomes the thing is like, you start to become hyper-present. And that was the first time, like, I felt like this is a flow I can control. Before, I was like, I'm just going to go do some crazy shit. But like that, I was like, I can put myself in these situations. And so then ever since then, pardon me, I really looked at how do I put myself in scary situations that are in some way that aren't illegal or that are like in a controlled kind of environment. But even like a scary situation for me could be like to get up and do stand up, right? Are you going to learn a new language? Are you going to like throw yourself into the unknown and doing that thing? And so, you know, making myself uncomfortable. And what I didn't understand at that time and what I understand it to be today is that I'm addressing my ego. In a way,
right.
Kind of, you know, curtailing that omniscient kind of feeling that is really unrealistic and kind of grandiose, and going, I'm a part of this whole thing, this whole cellular thing that I don't really understand. And I'm just going to try to play my part. And then you go, okay, I'm gonna help as many people as I can. Or I'm going to, you know, like...
Well, that's where I'm interested in when did that... were you always like that? Did you always have a spiritual side?
I was pretty empathetic, and I was always looking for a spiritual thing. Like, I'd studied since I was little. Like, I was lost in books since I was a kid, right? Mythology, I would read a lot. Then I'd read a lot of the early American authors. And really got in like to Emerson and Thoreau and all that kind of thing, you know, John Locke. And when I was young, when I was 10, 11, 12, like my mind was just, I needed to be elsewhere. And so those were things. And then like ethics and shit. And then I started, the first fiction I read was like Louis L'Amour books, like old Western, you know?
Sure.
And I was like, wow, those are guys you could look up to. Those are guys that like, they stand for something, and like all that kind of stuff started to really matter to me. And then when I started hanging out with these guys, these are the guys I'm loyal to, and that like, you know, right. And then I demanded standards, which is interesting. I didn't tell you just said that. I didn't think that, but like I demanded standards in my life, standards of my friends' behavior, you know, like we're friends because you're not a lot of things and because you are for a lot of things, you know, it's like, I look at that too. Like, you know, with like the original guys really that were around, like you and me and Ari and Joey, and Joe, and when you look at that, like we're more advanced in life, we're further down the road of life, we're not in our 20s, you know,
right?
But all of those guys are all fantastic people that have all been found a modicum of happiness and success and are still on a track that's going higher and higher and evolving all the time. And it's like, it's really something about like having that figured out. I think that you get into a position where things are clicking and you're like, oh, this is the way. Like, it's like Eddie Bravo would talk to me about it, and he'd be like, you know, you want to get yourself on the same vibration as the universe.
Right.
And that's through appreciation. And so, like, all these things and, like, a lot of these spiritual practices kind of coalesced, I guess, in my mid-30s. And I go, this is how you want to start moving. And then you want to start moving in a way that's going to give the greatest good to the most people. And I used to hide with, like a false humility in a way or something like that, where it's like, where I didn't deserve it or I didn't want it, or I'd
right.
just look at my shoes and be like, you know, I'm grateful for this, and I'm not in prison, I'm not dead, I'm not a junkie, I'm not like, or whatever. But even at that, I tell this story sometimes, and it's crazy. Like, I've been sober for a long time now, like since that time, really. And so I don't drink, I don't do any drugs. And I was sitting and I was thinking about it. I was at this retreat and I was with all these people, and
AA retreat?
No, just like a thing, you know? And I was like, I'm just as capable as anybody in the room, you know? And a friend of mine right before that conversation had said, he goes, you know, feelings are facts. A lot of people are saying, you know, your feelings aren't facts and all that kind of stuff. And he says, my feelings are facts. It's valuable. It's who I am and it's how I see the world and how I perceive it and whatever. And I was thinking about that, and then this guy started speaking, and we listened to that, and I was like, I'm just as capable as anybody here. And this was just a few years ago. And I thought, that's weird. Like, I've never had that thought before. I've never right. felt that way before. Not ever.
Yeah.
Right? And so then I start thinking about it, and I go, you know, I always figured, like, the way my narrative for myself was, if there's a race, I'm going to be last.
Yes.
Like, you know? And then I learned, when there's actual race, I was like maybe sixth grade or something. And you're like, you're going to run a mile in gym class or whatever it is. And I was like, I learned I was tough. I was like, I'll finish and I won't be killed. Like, and then at that time I started, you know, defending myself in playgrounds, on the streets, at party. Like, and so I was like, I might get beat down, but I'm tough. At least I'm not going to quit. Like,
right. This is when you were a kid.
When I was a little kid.
Yes.
And then, you know, I look at it and I'm like, I kind of always felt that way. And then I start looking at it and I go, okay. And I do a lot of writing and journaling and kind of reflecting on my life and looking at, you know, here's taking stock in your life and what it is. And I do that like every year. And I started thinking about the last time I'd done it. I go, you know, even when you're in that position where, you know, before all the madness happened, you're still a leader. Like, people are still looking up to you. You're, you know, articulate, you're thoughtful, read a lot, you've got a lot of information that other people don't have. Like, I was advanced in a lot of different ways, and I was like, that's interesting. And then I go, and then after all that, it's like I get hired at a place, and then I'm running a whole crew of guys, and then I'm running a couple different clubs, and then like I'm like escalated quickly, and I join jiu-jitsu, and I'm the best guy in the room, and then I'm one of the best guys.
So you're saying you're saying all this is somehow tied into
this is a thought, right? That I'm having at this moment.
Gotcha.
In this thing, right? And I'm thinking all this stuff, and I'm going through my life, and I'm thinking about that, and I'm like. And then, you know, you're on Ultimate Fighter and you're fighting the UFC. You're like, I was undefeated fighter for a bunch of fights. And then I'm acting, I'm in films, and then I fucking own a bunch of nightclubs. And then I'm like running a coffee company. And then I got like, and all this shit. And I'm like, but I'm the guy that's not going to finish the race, is my narrative, right?
Right.
And I went back to my friend and I go, feelings aren't facts. And I go, that's what the fuck they mean. Right? The way I feel about myself and I perceive myself is delusional.
Yeah.
You know? And then at that time, it was like, I was like able to go, okay, it's important to have a realistic view of who this is inside.
Because here you are, a person who has had all this great success from what you just described. Not only that, but you also have the great redemption story, which is that you pulled yourself out of a trajectory that could have led to complete obliteration. So you have that going too, which is a very mythological, very archetype. You know, it's really cool. So you have that thing going, and yet still, no matter what the universe is showing you, which is like, look, I've given you this and this and this and this, and you've accomplished all this, you're still thinking to yourself, kind of a piece of shit.
Right.
That to me is such an interesting aspect of humans. From doing this podcast, I've really noticed that that's like an omnipresent thing where, and just from meeting people out here in LA, you run into people out here who have the most ridiculous success, or they're the most incredibly beautiful, or they're the most whatever it is. And yet still, they cannot accept the fact that they deserve it.
Right.
They just think it was an accident. They think it was a fluke. That it's going to go away. Any good thing that comes.
But it's going to go away, that the other shoe's about to drop. Dude, that's how I live my life, Duncan. I was like, things are good right now, but... And anymore, man, I go... And then what I tell everybody, anybody that comes to me for counsel or anything, I'm like, you've been okay. You've been carried your whole life. You've always been fed. You've always had a place to live. People have always loved you, even if you didn't deserve it, whatever. What is to make you think, if you've had 30 years of success like that, that tomorrow's going to be any different? It's only going to get better, you know? And the more goodness that you put out, the more goodness comes, and all that stuff. And so anymore I look at it and I go, yeah, my life's pretty good right now. My bank account's pretty good right now, all that. And I'm like, there is not one thing to make me think that this won't be fucking twice as good next year.
There you go.
And that's so dope to get into that consciousness.
But that decision.
And that's a new thing for me, bro. That's a new thing.
That's a big decision. And it's interesting.
This, I mean, I know you know you're coming from a Mini Cooper up to a Mercedes. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I know. And I have not quite. I can do the pull up that you're talking about from time to time. But I'm more often than not, it's hard for me to do that pull up. Like, I have to consistently tell myself, this is okay. You can be successful. You don't have to be someone who's not successful. But it's not like it's hard to accept. And it's to me, that's been one of the great teachings in my life is like, whoa, look at this. No matter how much love comes to me in whatever form that it comes, my tendency is
a negative. Yeah.
And that's a wild.
It's interesting. And I don't know if that's for human, because I know some guys. Like, I don't think Joe is like that, right? I don't think he has that like that. I know people that think I'm fucking crazy. Like, I tell them that story, and they're like, you? Like, it doesn't even make sense that that is something that is inside me.
It's a universal ghost that haunts everybody, and to the point where I'm suspicious. Sometimes when I see someone who's, like, acting incredibly confident, sometimes I wonder to myself, is this just a – are you just putting on
putting
a show?
Putting on airs.
But here's, you know, the whole thing, like, feelings are not fact.
Right.
If you really do an analysis of what you are, or if I look into
certainly
myself, right, quite often what I come up with is that there are feelings that are in a field of awareness, and the field of awareness is a thing outside of definition, which means that the feelings come after this initial – I'm aware of my feelings. This is what they call the – watcher, the observer, the
right.
Atman, the
Eckhart Tolle kind of deal.
Yeah, that seems to be what we really are, is this thing that In the Bhagavad Gita, when it's, they call it the soul, a lot of people call it the soul, but in the Bhagavad Gita, when they're describing it, they say, it was never born, has never died, it does not come into being, it does not cease to be, it cannot be burnt by fire, withered by the wind.
Is this like, they say sometimes the unknowable and unnameable?
That's it.
Yeah, right? The Taoists would speak of?
It's like you can't look at yourself without a mirror. You can't turn around and look at yourself. Right. This is the observer self. And that thing really doesn't care about how definitions, or it doesn't really care. Everything precedes this initial state, right? So to me, what that means is, and this is something that kind of gets echoed by Jean-Paul Sartre when he talks about, who you should definitely check out if you haven't already, but he talks about how if we take a paper cutter, right, the paper cutter is just a fucking paper cutter. It doesn't have to decide what it's going to be. The paper cutter didn't have to go to college. It doesn't have to define itself. It doesn't have to listen to certain kinds of music and wear cool clothes, and it doesn't have to do it. It's just a paper cutter, a human. We have to tell ourselves what we are. We have to decide, this is what I am. I am whatever it is you want to be, and that's why it's called a human being, because we're the being. We're in the process of being a thing, and we're always outputting. We always have to put out this thing that we are, and Sartre said, that's hell. That's hell. We're all in hell. He was a dark motherfucker, but he's like, we're all in hell. There's no way out of it. Your ultimate emptiness. You can only make up what you are from moment to moment, but you know the whole thing is a big charade. That's Sartre. But then if you read Camus' response to that kind of dark existentialism was, yeah, except...
And?
Yeah, and...
That, awesome to get to choose.
That thing, exactly. That's it. And the fact that I am the one who makes the ultimate decision to smile in the face of oblivion, that makes me more powerful than the gods. Right. And so that moment of decision-making that you're talking about, I'm really interested in that when you realize you're not going to get an emotional backup for when you decide that you're okay. You're not going to get, your emotions aren't right away going to be like, oh yeah, you are a great person.
Right.
Nothing.
You got to train yourself. It's discipline. So everything comes to discipline and awareness, I believe. Right.
Yes.
So like what we're talking about with that, like it takes so long to, everybody thinks they're enlightened or that they have a higher consciousness. And it's like, what I'm seeing more and more is it's like there's slivers of awareness. And if you're unaware, you're unaware that there's even more things to be aware of.
Right.
Like you just did and if you can't reflect and go, here's where I was unaware, here's where I just became aware of. Because your confidence is so messed up that you have to just put on airs, as you say, it's like then you're never aware. Also, you're just pretending to be aware all the time. And those are the people that I go, oh, it's hard to be around that person.
Yeah.
And that's why I like am so excited about going, I can control my universe by, all the people that I get to be around. And I get to choose that.
You get to choose. And before you choose the people you get to be around, you can just make this decision.
Sure.
Which is, I'm cool. You can just decide. It's a scary thing when you realize.
And that's the thing people don't like.
Yes.
Because there's an accountability and a responsibility to say, I am a plumber. They're like, ooh, instead they're like, I don't know if I'm good enough to be a plumber. Can I pass the plumbing test? I don't, like,
yeah.
Or something creative. Like,
artist.
I'm a writer. Like, now you got to shake your own tree. I mean, as a fighter, I'm a fighter. You got to shake your own tree, get your own sponsorships, find your own fight. Like, that's a lot to do. Like, you're not getting a paycheck at the end of the week from that job. As an actor, I'm already on my last job. Every time I work, it's like, I'm already looking for my next job because I'm about to be unemployed. And so, but I've been in that position. I get comfortable with that because I've been shaking my own tree for a long time. And so it's kind of like I can live in that space. I don't need to have that check at the end of the week to have comfort and go, oh, my phone bill will get paid.
But don't you think like all
taking time?
But all the it seems like there is a direct core. I mean, this is where you get the cliche secret bullshit, but it is kind of true, which is that. The moment you decide,
the manifestation.
When you decide you're okay, like you just make, you realize, like, here's the, like, you know about the third, you know about Buddhism, the temptations of Buddha.
Sure.
So you know the third temptation when the Buddha was about to get enlightenment. Do you know what that is?
No.
So Mara, I'm sorry guys, I talk about this too much, but Mara, the Lord of Death, appears to the Buddha. He's already tempted him twice. The first temptation is by throwing fireballs at him or just all these terrible things, and the Buddha laughs and the fireballs turn into flower petals. But that's supposed to represent overcoming the fear of your own annihilation or death or whatever. And then the second temptation, Mara sends to the Buddha his daughters. And any of this can be interpreted any way you want. But his daughters, some people say that represents worldliness or living in the world of pleasure. That's what I used to think. And other people say, no, actually, the daughters of Mara are letting go of your attachment to when you start waking up to getting prideful over it, to like getting like puffed up and like, oh, I'm such a holy man. Or something. There's a lot of things. But the third one, man, that's my favorite one, which is that finally Mara, it's really not the Lord of Death. It just represents the king of the world, sure. Represents the world. But Mara says to the Buddha, and this is the third one, and theoretically these are in order of difficulty, you know? Okay. So this is his last-ditch attempt to keep the Buddha from getting enlightened. The third one was a question. Why do you deserve to be the Buddha? And the answer was that the Buddha took his finger and touched it to the earth. And then, bing, enlightenment. And that's always been a mysterious moment for me because I think, what does that mean? And I've asked different people. Everyone's got their own interpretation. But to me, it's that realization that you have to make the fucking decision. Mm-hmm. You just decide. You just decide now, regardless of your success, regardless if you have a ton of success or none at all, you just make the crazy decision at the second, I deserve love. I'm a good person. I'm okay. I'm okay. You have to make the decision yourself.
And then that goes into all the things. Like, I mean, this sounds like super ethereal talk that we're having, but it's like, that is like meat and potatoes stuff of like, okay, so your boyfriend doesn't treat you very well. He gets drunk and sometimes he calls you a bitch or he stays out too late. It's not his problem. That's not his fault. That's how he is showing up. What is it about you that would stay around for that? Why is it that you think that that's what you deserve or that? And so like these things to me, these kinds of lessons are fascinating to me because they come up in life everywhere, man. Like when you ask yourself that, but people don't want the decision. I didn't want the decision, rather, of being accountable to my decisions. So it's easier for you to tell me, hey, where do you want to have lunch?
Right.
Because I don't want to say what I want. And right. You know what I mean? I want to be a people pleaser in that way. And so like we all live this fucking crazy nebulous of going, well, I wonder what he thinks that I should be like, and then I'm going to try to be like, and it's like,
you know what I mean?
It's the craziness.
Craziness.
I was reading a thing about computers, and there's a, I can't remember, it's like Cleverbot or something about these bots, right? And it mimics human.
Yes.
And so you're talking to them, and
yeah.
There's a great thing on Radiolab about them. And you can ask them any questions. They put them online, and then people could ask questions, and the idea was if you would write in, hello, to the computer, then it would know the one word, hello. And then, how are you today? Then it would know a succession of sentences based upon your interaction with it. Then they put it online, and everybody started asking. So then pretty soon, it has 4 billion things that it knows or whatever. So you could actually write in questions and go, hey, why am I sad? And there would be an answer. So they're doing this online, and they're going, so why am I sad, Cleverbot? And the answer comes back, because. And that's based on, like, a conversation that it had with another person. Like, so you're talking to ghosts. Right? And it's then there must be more. Why am I sad? Because you stay in the same place for too long, is the answer. And I thought, what a brilliant answer. But that's just the answer that one guy had. But it's like, you get into these things where you're like,
brilliant.
Where you talk about the humanism of machines and, like, where we go into that and, like, what. I mean, it begs a lot of different questions.
Because you stay in the same place too long. And it doesn't have to be a geographic place either.
Not a bit.
It's just,
right?
Well, that's, you end up in this.
Made me question my whole life. I'm like, every decision, like, oh my God. And what am I hanging on to? Like, it goes back to what you're talking about my attachments.
Well, right. Yeah. And when you start realizing that, I think it's beautiful that it's built into the universe that you can be imprisoned in a certain thought structure or ego pattern or paradigm and live your whole life beaten down, cowled by the world, trying to please everybody.
Right.
And at any moment that you want to, you can instantaneously free yourself from 80% of what's obstructing you, which is just the way you look at yourself. It's always there for you. It's so cool. It's like a prison. Like, imagine a prison where with no roof, with no ceiling. No, a prison with no ceiling. Very high walls, no ceiling. But all the prisoners had the ability to levitate if they wanted to. They just had to do it, you know? And every once in a while, you'd see a prisoner go shooting up through the fucking ceiling. And most prisoners would be like, one in a million chance. Nobody can do that. He works so fucking,
crazy, right?
You know, but we can all do it. Except this isn't, this, you know.
That's one of the things about being an actor for me, is that everybody says that. When I'm a little kid for forever, or being a fighter, can't be in the UFC.
Right.
Can't do that.
Right.
That's crazy. Right?
Yeah.
So I start thinking about all that shit and I go, yeah, it is. I mean, numbers wise, nobody's wrong when they say it's one in a million or whatever the fucking number these statistic fucking people put out. Like, fuck a statistic, because my name's Tate Fletcher. You know what I mean? And it's like, and I won't quit. Like,
right.
That's what I know about me.
And
so you know who those 999,000, you know, like all the people right up to the one in a million. Those are all people that gave up. Like, right. You don't give up.
Yeah.
It'll occur.
But something even better will occur, even if that doesn't occur.
Dude, you're on the road. Then that's the thing, is you have to choose a destiny. It's like in, like, The Prophet or any kind of book. Like, when you read The Alchemist, it's like, he has to choose it. It's not about getting to the pyramids.
Yeah.
It's just, like, things take him and distract him along the way that are even better and grow his soul as a human.
But what is that cheesy quote in the very beginning of Gladiator? I'm sorry, you guys, but I always think about it, where they're riding into battle and he says, if we die today, we will drink in Valhalla. Or so, it wasn't right. Valhalla, it was somewhere.
Whatever.
Yeah. But it was, it's the warrior's
creed.
Creed, which is like, there is no reward on earth that can equal the glory of dying fighting for your life.
Yeah.
That's the glory, right? And there's no...
Not even your life. For your flag.
For
an idea of what this flag is and what it represents of your family and your kids and your hopes and your grandfathers and everything, right?
I mean, when I say your life,
yeah,
I mean fighting to peel back the entropy that has kept you trapped in your... The thing that's keeping you...
Truly, I hear people talk about, I fight for a living, like we're doing this for a living. We just watched the fights yesterday on television, and the guy was like, hey man, this is our job, you know, and so thanks for supporting us, what I was saying to the fans. But I'm like, it's not, man. Like, I mean, it is, but it's not. Like, to me, that's like a muted idea of what it is. You're fighting to release all those things and go, who am I now under these strictest, harshest conditions that
right.
I can come up with in America? I mean, that's a huge statement to say, and somebody's going to say, well, you know, there's homeless or whatever. But, like, you're putting yourself in a really highly advanced...
You mean physical, like,
to be in
US,
a physical
yeah,
fight,
yeah.
To fight in the UFC, to fight in, like...
You're crushing
so
yourself.
So when you do that, you're, I mean, you're in an elongated state of discomfort for months and years to be able to train yourself, to be able to do that thing. And there's an uncovering and a discovering of yourself within that.
But if you lose the fight, you still won, right?
Exactly.
You have been given the great teaching.
And that's the thing,
of
man.
The being and that.
I sat there at
yeah.
one of my friends' fight. He was one of my best friends, Isaac Valley Flag, and he was getting beat down by this guy. And it was before Isaac got in the UFC. And I was like, this is fucking bad. He got caught bad, knocked out. The guy mounted him, he's beating him, Isaac keeps moving enough to defend himself, gives him his back, like, it was all bad, it got clipped again, and then by the second round, he was, I think, maybe he made it to the second or third round, but I'm like, and I was reflecting on the way home, it was a long drive home, and I was like, that was a fucking bad deal, and but then I had flashes of the guy's corner on the other side, and I was like, they're happy as anything. I'm like, it's not a bad fight or a good fight, it's just a fight.
Right.
And depending where I'm sitting, my perspective is what makes it good or bad. I'm like, there's no good or bad. This is just a fight and experience. And what a fucking a bunch of gratitude that you can have that you're able to be a part of that thing. And like what you're saying, you know, and I had lunch with this chick earlier today and that came up, you know, she's like, well, the world is empty and meaningless,
mm.
you know? And I go, absolutely. And I said, how fucking, and like what you were saying earlier, what a great opportunity. Because that means, everybody would always say, you live in a fantasy land, man. You need to fucking just buckle down, get a job, do whatever. Whatever their status quo is, who all of those fuckers email me and send me shit on Facebook to the point where I got to block them because they're too dumb. How did you do this, man? I got two kids. I went to church. I got the job. I went to college. I fucking hate myself and my wife. This is horrible. And I'm like, you listen to all the shit that didn't make sense from people that were failing at the very same construct they were giving you to live, dummy. Like, you know what I mean? And it's like, that's what happens generally.
Yeah.
But like, she says, so it's meaningless and whatever, whatever. I'm like, what an awesome opportunity to give it whatever meaning you want.
Yeah.
I live in a fantasy. Come check it out. You know what I mean? Make it whatever you want it to be, because that's what it can be. And that's the beautiful part about it. I mean, there's no way that it makes sense, dude. Like I was supposed to go to college and do a great thing. I became a drug addict with a bad alcohol problem and the whole thing and a bunch of run-ins here and there. But it's like when you had cancer and you're like, you know, you're a cancer survivor, Duncan. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Great. You're a cancer survivor. Fuck yourself. Like, that discredits everything else that I am, that I really am. This is just a thing that happened. And that's kind of how I view that stuff. It's like, there's a lot to surmount and all that kind of stuff. But that's not me. That's nothing about me. It's a stranger to me.
Right.
And it's a stranger to anybody that knows me. It's almost like that's like, really? Like, that's crazy. So I've lived that life. I've lived a life of recovery. I've lived a life as a professional athlete. Lived a life as a, like, all those things. And the thing is like, I'll just try. Like, that's my whole mantra is I need you to try. Like, I want everybody to try. I want everybody to win because I think all that is possible. And I don't think there's any separation or dissimilarity between us. You know, like the skin of me or a dude making a pot in India is no different than even the pot. It's like we're all made up of the same carbon and the same kind of energies that
yes.
warm us and cool us and propel us through this life. And so like, whatever this, I think that's maybe what the Catholics or a Christian would think of as the Holy Spirit is like the thread that weaves all of our souls together and is this unified kind of God shield that is all of us, that we all come from and go back into this pool of souls that is the one.
Well, this is, and that thing that you're talking about, I was just listening to a lecture by the founder of the Hare Krishna is talking about this very thing. He's
glad they got those fucking people out of the airport. Am I right though?
I know. I like it when I like running into, listen, I tell you, I'd rather run into,
I read their book.
I'd rather, the which one?
I don't know. The one that goes and it culminates with, yeah, you eat meat because that's a grotesque part of getting energy. And then you become a vegetarian because you're more enlightened. And then when you get to the highest point of spirit, you can absorb all your nourishment through the air.
That's not the Hare Krishna.
Like, okay.
No, that I don't think that's the Hare Krishna. Though they do definitely have some serious flaws, because there is the what they're based on is it's a type of yoga called Bhakti Yoga.
And so, is that a thing that stimulates DMT in their brain? Is that a thing? Like, there's like a lot of yogi poses that they would talk about, if you get good at this and you're practicing this for years and years and years, that these will cause psychedelic states.
Well, I think it's even more powerful than that, in the sense that it's what you just said, which is we're all part of this one pool of existence. All energies are all connected and make up this one super entity composed mm-hmm. of all things. The step that they take is they say that entity, that sum total of all things, which is called, I'll mispronounce it, but it's called asinka sinka beta tattva, simultaneous oneness and difference. So that thing, that sum total of all things, is God. And bhakti yoga is the practice of falling in love with everything. So you now recognize, isn't that cool? But that's not owned by the Hare Krishna. See, that's a very old
spiritual tenet.
Right.
Yeah.
But they, you know, the Hare Krishnas, or Prabhupada, the guy who brought it here, was very, very good at talking about what the implications of all that is. And so it's the idea that all this stuff out here, every single thing around you is just God energy.
Right.
And I think the name is called maybe Prakriti, as the name they have, you know, Hinduism's rad. They have a lot of cool terms for it. It's all this God energy. And so the dimension that we're in right now is marked by ignorance. That's a that's the quality.
That makes sense.
That's the quality of this dimension, because we have all forgotten. Most people have forgotten.
We're without knowing.
We are without knowing. We're ignorant of the fact that we're surrounded by God.
Except for the arrogant ones that are like, oh, well, I got this dialed in. I know.
Yeah, right.
Like, how can you possibly know? Like, and why is it so hard to go, this is the greatest mystery ever, and I'm a part of it. Wild. I hope when I die. That's what I always hoped since I was a little boy. I was chasing death since I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. Little boy. Little. 7, 8. And I was like, I can't wait to die. Because I was just sure that when I died, I'd be fucking omniscient. Like, there would be a snap of the fingers, and I would be flooded with knowledge of all my questions answered, all the huge realization and oneness. Like, I knew that as a little boy. And it's crazy. Like, little kids, you mess with little kids, man. And if you could get them comfortable and talking, they're amazing little creatures.
Oh, yes.
There's a great – I used to always put Kitchen Soup for the Soul by my toilet.
Yeah.
And I know it's funny. And I would read it, and there's one story in there with one of them, and it was this guy, they had a baby, and they are getting ready to take the baby home from the hospital. And they had a daughter that was like 5 or 6 or whatever. It was like, let me be alone with the baby. We're in the hospital. I want to get home. Da, da, da. Okay, let me be with the baby. And they're like, there's the jealousy thing. Or like, they didn't know really what's going on. They get home. They set up the crib, and they put the baby in the baby room with the crib. And she's like, hey, I need to see the baby. Can I see the baby? And they're like, yeah, go in and be quiet. Don't wake her up. And go in and see the baby. And they're kind of peeking through the crack in the door and watching. And the little girl goes up and she says, hey. She says, will you tell me what God looks like? Because I'm starting to forget. And it's like, and that's like a crazy fucking idea. and a crazy idea. Like, I know, like, I have a memory that predates my birth, right? Like, I have and I don't know if that's some machination of my own, you know, illustration of my greatness or whatever.
Who knows?
Some kind of weird latent arrogance that, like, But I have a memory and a vision of this time when I'm floating in blackness and space, and that I existed, and I thought it was strange that I'm coming down to these people to be in their home, you know, like kind of thing, like really odd. And then the more I say that, like I talk to other people that have similar experiences sometimes, you know?
It's only odd from the POV of this culture, from the POV of a large percentage of humans on the planet. That's just, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's normal. Yeah. I mean, you're going to get like, The Dawkins school and the
Dawkins the
Richard Dawkins. Yeah, Dawkins. I think the Richard. That's a great idea for a new cover band, like Richard Dawkins. It's like,
yeah,
people
godless
replace Dawkins lyrics with Richard Dawkins.
What do you need to Richard Dawkins?
I think we need people like that. And
for what purpose?
Well, I think that he helps me because people like him and Hitchens, who say things like, and I'll misquote it, but when they say things like, something like lack of evidence, there's a great atheist quote.
He's the guy that wrote The God Delusion, right?
Yeah. So I used to get really,
Hitchens was beautiful, I think.
I get annoyed with atheists sometimes.
I do too.
And skeptics, but then if I stop being annoyed and really take what they're saying.
Right.
And try to apply it to my life.
I get annoyed on semantics, though, of it. Of like, you're not really. If you're an atheist, man, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're more learned on this than I am, for sure. But like, if you're an atheist, you're the same coin as a believer. The very same. You're just the other. You're the tails.
Well, no, I think they would say absolutely not.
I would say that because a believer is saying, I know Jesus Christ is the way and the light. Or whatever, and no way to heaven except through him type thing, right? And an atheist would say, I know that there's no God and that you just turn to dirt and you're back into dust at the end of the day.
I don't think all of them say there's no God. They just say, let's keep things where we can prove it with evidence.
So let's talk about an agnostic then. That's without knowledge of what that would be, right? And that's kind of where I feel like I'm at. If those are the correct definitions, I don't know. I'm open to whatever, but like, there's no way that we humans know.
Well, I mean, the way I look at it is, okay, fine. On one level, no God, all atoms, that's it.
Right.
Fine. Got it. Believe it. I know it's true, and thank God people like you are analyzing the universe at this level only without getting obstructed by some kind of philosophical, metaphysical bullshit, because thanks to you, there's radiation therapy that cured my cancer, that, you know, there's like, there's great, great.
I didn't know that Dawkins made radiation
therapy. Well, no, but the scientific yeah.
But that's the other fallacy, though, isn't it? Well, there's either science or there's God. Well, and that's bullshit. That's what people that have an agenda do, and they separate those two things. And I think they're the same thing.
There's a bunch of different – again, there's no one way of looking at it. A lot of people, like Crowley, who I love, who's like one of the
– Alistair?
Yeah, who's a great occultist. His one of his great sayings was, our method is science, our aim is religion. So his approach to it was, we'll use empiricism. We will only use what can be proven. We will be very strict in our data gathering and the results of our experiments. We will be very strict in noting what happens and not pretend something happened that didn't, because that's how we'll get to the truth. So there's a lot of different ways of looking at it, but the way I see it is this. When I cannot deny the fact that when I pray, especially gratitude-related prayers, if I just start saying thank you to some kind of super intelligence in the universe, and I start doing that regularly, I get happier, synchronicities happen more.
Most powerful prayer in the world is thank you.
Amazing things happen, and I can't deny that evidence. Even if I was to write down...
But then you can easily argue that also and say, well, yeah, you're controlling your brain and the patterns in your mind and the synapses and the neurons to go ahead.
But
and,
I don't care.
I don't care either. So I just want a result.
So to me, it's like if you want to get caught up in whether or not by saying these words...
Like an internet argument.
Yeah, go ahead.
Like I put a thing out and it was like, reasons people rape people and three check marks, right? Like... short dressed or whatever, you know, the skimpy clothing.
Yeah.
Flirtation. Because I'm a rapist. And like the third box is the only box. And I put that because I saw it. I thought it was funny. And I was like, what a cogent idea. Like, of course, like it's only a rape. Like it's, that's what it is. It's a sickness in that kind of a way. And it's not any of these other things. And anybody else that tries to do any kind of assailing on a victim is a scumbag and whatever. And then there's all these conversations about it underneath that I never even look at.
Right.
Because I'm like, bitch, I'm not here to argue on the goddamn internet. You don't believe how much shit I got going on in my life. Because I'm sorry that you have all that. I've got this one guy.
Stop.
Like paragraphs.
You must make a t-shirt. Oh. You got to make a t-shirt that says, bitch, I'm not here to argue on the internet.
I got shit to do.
I would wear on the back. I would wear that all the time.
So good.
I'm not here to argue on the internet either. And I'm not here to like.
So like, I'm really in agreement with that. Like, I'm just here for the function and performance of it. If it's this, if it's that, like, whatever. Like,
yeah.
If it's Jesus, I'm with it. Cool.
Yeah. I think it's all atheists must perform the experiment. If they want to approach this stuff, they must perform the experiment of spending a nice month.
Or a year. Do all the actions.
However long they think it takes to like perform an experiment, spend some time.
Because without that, there's no real like thoughtful looking at the other side of it to go, okay, no, I know all about this. To think that you know all that, like contempt. That there's a great quote: contempt prior to invest. There's a principle which is a bar against any information. And against it, that will win any argument, and that is contempt prior to investigation. It'll leave a man in everlasting ignorance, right?
Wow.
That's huge, right? But how often we all get that? And until we really dive into it then, it's like you don't know anything. You've got some ideas about Christianity, or you've got some ideas about being Hare Krishna. But unless you live that shit and really go, okay, I'm going to listen to all the greatest thinkers in this thing, and then I'm going to do all the actions that they do on a daily basis with the discipline, you might not really know what the fuck you're talking about.
You can't.
Right.
That's the thing. And it's an intentional, I believe, you're intentionally cutting yourself off from that level of things because you don't want to deal with it right now. Maybe you're not here to deal with that shit right now. Maybe you're just here to deal with other stuff that, like atoms or mitosis or splitting atoms or all the wonderful things that are making the world so incredible. Maybe that's where
those
you're focused.
Silicone breasts that come up that are so soft that they're like real.
I thought they already had those.
So good they have them.
Well, there you go. That's all thanks to people who are godless.
No, it isn't.
Evil sinners. No, I'm
completely and fully into the Church of Heresy. I mean, like, all that, like, any, you just got to question all these things, man. And then be nice and kind. The thing that I have a problem with, like, some of those guys is they get, it's like Nietzsche. It's like, he's such a negative Nelly. You know what I mean? It's like, you get into these things where it's just like, you're just sad. And so, like, is your sadness and you not ever dealing with how your dad treated you or whatever, is that coloring your whole narrative that is your philosophy now?
Yeah.
You know, and, like, the Dawkins or the, like, if you're going to take that route, man, smile a lot and be super kind and put your hand out and hug a lot of people because that shit is important.
They don't want to. They're angry. And you know,
no
man.
It's no good, man. It's, I feel bad for them. It's like, that is why you get cancer.
There was a thing called the age of...
Sorry, Christopher Hitchens.
Do you know the age of faith? Have you ever heard of that term?
I have.
So I just read, you know, I love reading, but the older I get, I think the dumber I get. So I've actually...
I've been... Because that's what I do.
Even worse, man. I've been curious about communism. So I ordered a comic book breakdown of Karl Marx. So it's breaking down all the philosophies that made Karl Marx. And it's showing the different periods in human history.
A comic.
It's great. And it's actually
like watching Nixon to learn about history.
Really, it's actually pretty well done.
Scorsese.
So why not? Better than, at least you get a little bit. That's why I figured, at least I'll get a little bit. But it did say that there was a time period in human history during the time of the Great Inquisition.
Right.
Where talking like this, the way we're talking right now, would get you murdered by crazy people who believed in a very specific kind of God. But really, these crazy people, they didn't maybe so much believe in God. They just figured out a way to get a lot of power by tricking dumb people into believing in an invisible thing. And because of that, they put the brakes on human discovery for a nice long time.
How much do you do that right now?
Well,
it's still happening.
Well, if you look at ISIS
in America.
But if you look at what's happening with ISIS,
right.
Imagine that's a version of this very same thing, which is religious fundamentalists using their religion as an excuse to oppress people and to hold up the paradigm they need.
About all that.
Yeah.
First thing, I was having a great conversation with a friend the other day, a group of people, and they're talking about like the Little Prince or something like that. Right?
Yeah.
And then one of them started laughing and pointing at another one. And she says, what? She goes, remember when you said you read that? She goes, I did read that. And she goes, oh, tell them how you read it. And so I go, well, how'd you read it? And she says, Wikipedia. Which was like, I thought that's fucking so good. It's like a comic book.
Wow.
But anyway, the whole thing about ISIS too, you know, like when you respond to gossip or negativity or whatever, like a troll on Twitter or something or whatever, that makes him bigger. Ooh, now he's on.
Right? Yeah.
Kind of thing. And so, like, I wonder if, like, I don't know the scope of it. I know, like, a woman that I really love that's a medevac pilot. And there's fucking horrible shit that's happening in northern Iraq right now. It's fucking awful. The shirt that I'm wearing, my cousin is a Navy SEAL, and he got shot, and he's in recovery right now.
Wow.
And I didn't even know we were at war last spring, right? Like, type of shit. Like,
wow.
It's like, we're in gunfights all the time. Tim Kennedy is in, like, he's in service, and he is out there protecting people as a top-notch ranger because there's fucking bad people doing bad shit. The other side of that is, like, we've decimated Iraq. And we're into this position, and ISIS is, what, 20,000 people deep or something like that?
I don't know.
It's not a whole bunch of guys. And the more we pay attention to that, I'm like, what is this distraction about also? I kind of also think that because we don't send troops there. We have minimal forces there that it's like we're mired in defeat in that way. It's kind of like going into Vietnam, which was a false flag event. And like I just wonder on the scope of history, like where we have – so my point is, do we have psychopaths? Is everybody that's in power anywhere, whether it's for a corporation or a government, are they all psychopaths? Because there is, like, something that's happening here where people are playing with people's lives. They're not for all the patriotism and everything that every fucking politician, they're all voting against sending troops to where it would make an area safer and make less people die. And they're kind of committed to not winning a war. It seems weird, man. It's like we have a lack of...
You don't want to win a fucking war. God, so Jesus, weird. If you're a weapons manufacturer, the last thing you want is to win a fucking war.
That's the thing. And so, like, well, that's what I say. It's like when we have psychopaths in charge of things. It's like corporations. I rail against corporations all the time. I think our government is just a shadow of corporations. I mean, I don't think that. It's obvious. And if you don't think that, you're retarded.
Jimmy Carter just said...
You're thinking it through.
Jimmy Carter, I'll send it to you. Jimmy Carter just came out saying... Just breaking all down. He's like, this is an oligarchy. We're in an oligarchy.
When did his awareness come to that? When he was president or recently?
I don't know if it's like tied into the fact that he got this cancer diagnosis.
And was just like,
yeah, it seems like that, man. But he was always kind of,
And they say he's one of the smartest guys ever to sit in the chair.
Yeah, man. And it is an oligarchy.
And he's colored as a dummy.
Yeah, right. Jimmy Carter. What do they say? He loves jelly beans.
Isn't that crazy?
Or was that,
no,
Reagan?
That was Reagan?
Oh yeah.
He's the peanut guy. Peanut farmer.
That's it. Carter, right. The peanut farmer.
It's weird though. I mean, so when you look at that, and you look at when we talk about spiritualism, when you talk about like a transcendence is what we're all looking for, whether we know it or not. I think that's what we want, right? And so I rail against these corporations. But, like, corporations are just things. They're tools. It's like a fucking gun or a microphone. It's just a tool. It's nothing. As long as it's used with the conscience of humanity, right? But the problem is that there's people that are, maybe they're almost like Asperger-y type people, like accountants, are like, a lot of those guys think in a certain way. And so they'll not think about humanity so they can think about a profit margin that's greater for stockholders or whatever.
Right.
Like, here is the job. And it's like at a certain point, if I'm a corporation, I am a corporation owner and a few different ones, I want everybody to have health care. Like I did that before any of the fucking Obama forced people to. It made it worse for me when he did. It made it more expensive. But it's like I wanted everybody that works with me to, like, I want everybody to be taken care of because they're
cool.
My friends. And if they get hurt, I'm going to pay out of my own pocket anyway. So let's make sure everybody gets taken
right.
care of. You know what I mean? It's like and so – like, that's what I mean about corporations with the humanity. You've got to have somebody steering it that has a conscience and that has a loving kind of exposure to the world. And we don't have that at a certain point anymore. And I don't know what happens because it's kind of maybe coupled with the idea that, like, people that are liberals in their 20s and 30s become conservatives in their 40s, 50s, and or whatever.
Well, I don't think we ever had it. Like, I don't know when we – like, the whole system – and this is not just because I briefly read a comic book on – Karl Marx.
He's read more than comic books, folks.
But the whole system, the way the thing works is, at least after having read this, it does seem to make sense. Please refute it if you can. But the idea is the person who owns the production facility, whatever it may be, the person who has the capital,
right,
he uses that capital to buy life energy from workers, right?
Okay.
That's just the way it works. So I hire you, and basically what I'm doing is I'm saying, if you will give me 8 of your life energy, eight of your breathing hours, I'm going to pay you $30 an hour. But I'm going to convert that $30 an hour
right.
into a profit for me of $20 an hour. So or $60
whatever.
An hour, whatever, right? So what ends up happening there is that the worker always gets the same amount of money per week, but the boss always gets more and more and more and more and more and more and more money. And that has created the situation, the inevitable situation, where 1% of the people on Earth have 90% or 99% of everything in the world, because the end result of that mixed in with inheritance laws
right.
is that all the stuff gets sucked away and then it gets sucked out of the people, and that's just
it's
the
like
way
a UFC contract.
Right.
It is. Those contracts are like, even if you have a doll or something and your doll sells well, you get like a pittance for that, right?
Right.
But when you die, you know what your kids get?
What?
Nothing. Like, it's not even part of your estate. Like, all that shit, like, whatever you've done, if you're getting royalties for something, that goes away on your death.
There you go, yeah.
And it's like, and the government does that big way, too. And like, when you're talking about with inheritance tax and all that. We're going through that with my dad.
Well, it's insane. It's fucked, man. Yeah, it's but, crazy. But I mean, I, like, saying that,
here's something that's bought and paid for. You own this tract land. It's worth $50,000 when your dad bought it, and now it's worth $300,000.
Hello, my beautiful angels.
We're going to take $150,000 for it on his death, even though it's been paid for in full. And like, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. And there's a lot of different methods of gaming the system like that. Right. And, you know, there's got to be a middle line there. You know, it doesn't have to all be like what – because, like, if you read – it's scary what Marx wanted. There's, like, 10 things that he wanted, and it's – like, I consider it just fucked, man. It's like, you know, there's no –
that's because you're 1%.
No more private property. Everything. It's not that, man. It's that, because, like, I really one of the things I read that he said, which made a lot of sense. He's like, a lot of you are upset when we say that we are against private property, but most of you don't have private property. Just so you know, most of you don't own shit. The majority of the world doesn't own shit. They're all renters. They don't own nothing. Don't think you own anything because you don't.
Well, and even right now, it's not a good time to.
I'm renting. Well, right, but the point is, who owns it? You know, I'm renting this house. My car is a lease. I don't own it. I own these microphones, my computer. That's mine. But in general, most people don't own anything anyway. Mm-hmm. But Marx was saying, you know, it seems like what he was saying. God forgive me for saying Marx was saying, because who the fuck knows what he's saying? He said a billion things in a billion different ways, most
perhaps
of which
contradictory and everything else.
But one, but what he was advising is all inheritance goes to the state. There's no tax. If you die, it all goes to the state. All inheritance goes to the state. All property is absorbed by the state. We create worker armies, which is you get like groups of people who are no longer attached to their family.
And, I feel like he's not very involved.
Marx?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he was a fucking genius, and one third of the planet follows his philosophies, but it's like on
where do those people live?
China.
Okay, so that's awesome, I hear. From what I understand, being a citizen of China is awesome.
Well, we don't...
No, actually, I don't hear that. I hear that you can go to work, and gases you'll work with will melt your face off. You'll die young. If you're a woman, you won't even be born.
Well, like, yeah, there's no argument.
No, it's there's
no argument.
Right.
If you look at history... That method does not seem to work very well.
Yeah, like why I say not very evolved, it's like you can't take out the human component, right? Like, and so all men aren't created equal, regardless of what your daddy told you, right? Like, that's just not, it's not true. We're all we're born into different spots and places in our lives. Not just like, I was born under whatever, you know, like I'm George Bush's kid or something. It's like,
yeah.
That's not what I mean. What I mean is like, we have different skills, talents, and awareness. We're born with maybe different awareness of consciousness, right?
Yeah.
And so that being the case, under a Marx, that person is going to be imprisoned or killed because he's going to be trouble, a person that's of a higher elevation. Because you're not going to be satisfied with just being a worker in that kind of a construct.
Well, that and a zillion other things, which is like, what, you're going to fucking take away my family's property that's mm-hmm. been in their family forever? Like, the problem is this, man. So, okay, well, we won't do anything. Let's just let things keep going the way that they go.
Right.
And if things keep going the way that they go, then all that happens is the rich will continue to get more and more and more and more and more and more and more. They will control all the politics if they don't already. They'll control all the politicians if they don't already. So all that ends up happening is the disparity between
haves and
have-nots grows, and inevitably when that disparity gets to a certain level, which it isn't close to, at least in this country. I mean, back when Marx was spewing all this stuff out, like, they were sending toddlers to go into factories to work.
But you can already see it in other places, like, I was in Colombia last summer for a job, and it's like the chasm between rich and poor is profound.
Right.
It's profound.
And that only grows.
And that's happening. And then I go, oh, because they're not so far ahead. I'm like, this is kind of where America's going. Like, you can feel it. It's like palpable. You're like, oh, I can see the direction we're moving
in. Right. And that's a big problem because...
We're moving into third world status.
But it gets even worse when you consider the fact that within the next 40 years, self-driving cars and AI and robotics are going to...
That's the movie I'm doing right now.
Really?
It's about AI and all that kind of stuff, like in the future. It's crazy.
AI taking people's jobs?
Well, it's about AI. It's about the idea. Like when I was telling you about the thing... about the computer and the sad and all that. Why am I sad and all that? And the computer answering.
Yeah.
He was saying, you know, they became so much that if you were typing into a computer, you were typing into a computer and a bot was here answering and I'm asking you both questions, I'd be able to kind of tell who was the human and who was the bot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even if you're like, ooh, I don't have enough RAM to answer that. Yeah. I'd be like, oh, that's cute human that's making up a thing or something or whatever. But like, they said, so it started to become like 50-50, where people would get it right of who was the human, who was the bot.
Right.
And they go, which is kind of weird. And he goes, oh, I thought maybe it would be 51. He goes, no, if it went to 51-49, it would be really bad, because that would mean that the computer was more human than the human.
Yeah, that's right? Called passing the Turing test.
And that's like when they talk about singularity and stuff.
That's
like
on the way there,
going
yeah.
Going there, right?
Right.
So... But I don't know, my thing, like, you know, Elon Musk, he just donated $10 million or whatever.
Yeah.
Like that's, but you can't fight it, for one. I think that's weird that he did that, because there's no way that you can stop, you can't stop this ball of evolution that's going, you can't stop it.
You can't stop
it. The atom bomb, like, even if people knew all of that, they go, we know this is good. You can't stop it. You can't stop progression, which is a weird thing. He's got to know that.
Well,
but the problem for me isn't that, It's not the schism that we have that's between rich and poor or whatever. The whole problem, the crux of it for me lies in accountability. Of just like we're talking about, like I run from it in my own personal life. My life gets sadder and worse.
Right.
I stand up for it and I own myself. Then my life gets better. So the same thing thusly for our country or for our world, you know, to not speak in a nationalistic way, is that what we need is accountability, and what we do not have is accountability. You know, when we have corporations like Verizon or Bank of America that paid zero taxes last year with like $12 billion in profit,
yeah.
That's insanity. That's a cancer. That's a sickness.
Yeah.
And to have politicians then that are co-signing that to make that okay, that's fucking abhorrent. That's horrific.
Yeah.
And so we have zero accountability for that. So when, like, I don't know where your taxes are, but like last year or whatever, I went to 1% and I was like, fuck yeah. I'll tell you what, it's not so great. Because I'm in the bottom end of that pool. And that pool is fucking huge.
Right.
You make a couple, $300,000 a year, awesome. You know what? You're still kind of in the same place I was if I made 40 grand a year. It's
right.
Not like a huge deal. The people that have the fucking money, they're talking about the 0.01% of the 1% at the top have like something like 90% of it. It's not just like people say the 1% a lot, but when you put it into the scope and contextually what it is, it's fucking crazy. And I pay the same taxes that those guys pay that are making billions of dollars. And that is really insane.
What, like 50%, 48%?
Well, not only, but I mean monetarily. It's like there's ways to hide those money. You see big buildings that are just empty all the time. You're like, I wonder how on Fifth Avenue they keep that building. That's a skyscraper.
Tax write-off.
What company needs a $50 million a year or whatever that is staying empty? Tax write, like, and so they come to a zero sum. And then they accrue interest on the building as it appraises at a higher value each year. And then they have something to borrow. Like, that's fucking crazy.
Well, there you go, man. I mean, you see, that is what you're describing there is the problem, which is
right.
That obviously that is happening that way because – what happens is the bosses get richer and richer and richer.
Yeah.
They become that 0.01% that everyone.
That's an insanity, right?
But then they start controlling the governments
right.
of the world. And then when they start controlling the governments of the world, then all that's going to happen is the system is only going to be built to keep them in power and to keep everyone else out. You're going to want to tax people as much as you can to keep them weak
and
quiet because you don't want them to get up to where
and
you're
prisoners.
At. Right.
Because I want all prisoners, whether you're a prisoner that works at a Walmart and is too dumb to know you're a prisoner, or whether you're an actual prisoner that's behind bars. That, like, if I'm in power, that's what those people are looking for, right? But the thing is like, when we talk about this God field, or whatever, you know, this bay of souls that we all come from and go to and exist within if we're aware enough. The thing is that we look or some people, it's easy to look. And I think there's a trick that gets played. It's like a magic trick. It's like the same kind of magic trick. Like I see somebody on TV and I'm like, oh my God. And then I see them in real life. And I'm like, that's, and you're just in awe. And it's like, they've done nothing except been broadcast somewhere.
Right.
It's not, it's virtually nothing, literally. Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean I'm more valuable, or it doesn't mean anything.
Right.
And so, but the same kind of thinking goes into the thing when we see a duck covered in oil after an Exxon Valdez spill or something like that. And we're like, you know, or maybe even if we look at, we're sad and we go clean up a couple ducks and work for Greenpeace, which like almost nobody does, but they're real guilt ridden that are like, I need to make a difference. And you're not making a difference, but awesome that you want to try. I get it. And when you go into that kind of thing, the idea that I can look at that and not care about it and not be fucking just like feel like bile come up is because I think that I'm not that duck. Right? And that's that I am the same in the same environment. That's part of my food source. That's all part of me. That's all. And I'm thinking that I'm separate from that, you know? And it's like that vision that I keep having about like standing with a little boy at the fucking edge of the ocean and him going, Daddy, what was it like when you could swim? You guys used to swim. What does it feel like to be
right.
like that? Because we're at a place right now where it's coming where we can't be. The earth is belching up our secrets and our lies and our despicable acts back onto us. And we're not able to function in this world. We're not able to eat food that's healthy. And we're running from it in a way. And so, like, at what point is it that, I mean, there's no way we're headed for anywhere but destruction, right? The only thing we can have is a spiritual revolution of some kind and a consciousness. And you got to vote with your dollars. That's the only way. Why do I pay fucking more money for a cup of coffee and go decide where I want to go, or for grass-fed meat? Or why do I go farm to table and I give a big portion of Caveman Coffee proceeds to them so that they can fight corporate domination over the farmlands? Because I want small farmers to win. I need everybody to be sustainable. I need to go and support these people. And fuck yeah, if your eggs are fucking $4 at the supermarket and the farmers are $8, I'd rather buy them from the farmer and know that I'm going to get good health. You know what I mean?
Because
that feeds my body, man. And so it's nourishment. Like most of us are eating just to get through life and get through the day. But this is the nourishment of my soul. It guides my mind. It guides my emotions. And it guides where I go through the day consciously. And it's what I stand for. And yeah, that's worth a fucking couple more dollars. And so, like, that's the thing is, like, the only way through is a change in our consciousness, a spiritual change, and then a voting with our dollars. Like,
how does that start, the spiritual change?
I think through conversations like this. But
if I'm listening right now.
One of my guys told me this. He goes, hey, the spiritual way of life, 90% of it is having good manners when you don't want to.
Hmm.
Right? It's like I fight the ego inside me. Like, I don't feel like having good manners, and fuck you. And then everybody understands.
So that's so great.
Well, he's not really that way. He was in a bad mood or whatever. I don't want to be forgiven for a bad mood. I want to have you not know I was in a bad mood. I want to be able to be fucking loving and gracious in my interchanges with people all the time. So that's my goal. So then I try to walk carefully. So then I become what they call God conscious, which is I'm conscious of the God that's around all the time because I'm conscious, which is another word for aware, of my steps and where I'm putting them. Because it doesn't fucking matter very goddamn much. If you got a brand new pair of badass fucking shell-toed Adidas on, and you're just like, fuck, my white new shoes, I'm out here pimping and in Silver Lake, fucking awesome. And I walk by and I'm just texting on my phone and I step on your shoes and your shoes are all fucking dirty now. Now, I didn't mean that.
Right.
I was just not aware. I was self-absorbed. Right?
Yeah.
Does it make your shoes less dirty that I didn't mean it? So living intentionally, this God consciousness has become super interesting to me of like, I want to live with intention and have, like, I have dominion over where I put my goddamn feet. I just need to be thoughtful about it.
Right.
And so I think that's the thing. I think it starts right there. We can all be more thoughtful everywhere. You know, I used to think, what's my problem with my girlfriend? You know, why is that? And I go, oh, because I take her for granted. Because I'm a selfish, self-absorbed guy. And what I mean by that is like it doesn't come out that way. People I don't think would characterize me that way. But when I look at it and I look at the depths of it, I go, there's burrs on me that need to be brushed off and I need to be polishing that constantly. How does that show up for me? It shows up because I go, if I'm having a shitty day, I'll be like, I'll be short. I won't be as kind, as loving, maybe a hug or this or that or whatever happens, whether it's with my mom or my friends or whoever, because you know me and you know I'm not like that.
Right.
And so I take it for granted. I don't have to have manners around those close That's bullshit.
Wow, right. That's such an easy thing to do. Bullshit.
Who do we have the best manners with? Strangers.
Right.
The lady at the supermarket. I feel good because I was like, oh, well, how was your day today, Margaret? It's really nice. Thank you. Yeah, no, I need paper, not plastic. And you're super kind and nice and gracious to that person. You get home, you're like, and she's like, hey, how was your day? It's okay, whatever. I don't want to talk about it. What? That's rude. Anybody would characterize that as rude.
Right.
But we accept all this behavior from ourselves.
Right.
And I go, man, I need to be more conscious. I need to raise my awareness, you know? And I think that's where it starts. I mean, I needed a spirituality that I could sink my teeth into, that I could walk on. Because people would talk about this stuff, and it seems like these ethereal wisps of air. They're just out of your reach. That you kind of get an idea of, and it's like, where does it start? And I would ask guys, and this guy told me that, man. He goes, 90% of the spiritual way of life is having manners when you don't feel like it.
Love it, man.
Really beautiful, right?
Tate, that's a great way to wrap up this podcast.
Fantastic.
Thank you for coming, sir.
God
tell me, tell it.
So
do a quick plug for...
Okay. Well, I'm a purveyor of fine coffee beans, and I love it. And you can find us at cavemancoffee.com. And we do, you know, we're very careful about where we get it from, who we work with. We work with one single farm of guys that we know. Lacey is down... right now in Colombia visiting the farm, and she also works for a superstar that was the star of Mission Impossible. I can't say her name though. But like, so she's doing all that kind of thing. And so she and Keith Jardine and myself started this coffee company, Caveman Coffee. You can check us out anywhere. NuevoCerveza.com is a little micro brew that me and another buddy started, which is dope. And you can find that on Instagram too. You can find me at Tate Fletcher. My name's T-A-I-T. And I'm easy to find. And you can see me in upcoming films, I guess. Awesome.
Let's hear them. Which ones?
The Accountant with Ben Affleck will be out soon. There's something called Bloodfather with Mel Gibson. I'm in Sicario with James Brolin and Benicio Del Toro and Emily Blunt. Just a little thing in that, but it's awesome. I hope it all comes out. I get to yell in Spanish fucking getting these guys out of the car and killing everybody. It's rad. And then we've got a TV show. There's a great new TV show coming out on HBO called Westworld with Anthony Hopkins and Ed Harris.
You're in that?
Yeah. I've been working on that for the last 3 weeks.
Wow.
And that's all about AI and about like
Westworld. I know it. I know what it's based on,
original
man.
Original Yul Brynner show back in 73. So doing that, and then the next couple of days, I'm on a show called The Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., a Marvel TV series. And so that'll be out probably in a couple of weeks. I don't know. I think that's it. Yeah.
It's great. You're doing so good, man. You're an inspiration, Tate.
Man, it's a pleasure, dude. I feel so fortunate. And I really, like I say it all the time, and I'll say it to you right now, and it's super important to me that people know, because you don't know when anybody goes. But, you know, you make an impact. You know, you make a huge impact on me, and I'm glad you're my friend. It's like, it's important, you know, we have those people around that your heart feels full,
man.
And you feel risen up by, like, and you're definitely one of those guys, you know, and it matters, you know. It matters a lot, and I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, man. Thanks for this inspiration. You're a super cool guy. I feel the same way, Tate.
Thanks,
man.
All right.
Thanks for listening, everybody. A big thank you to Casper Mattresses. Go to Casper.com. Use offer code FAMILYHOUR to get $50 off your order. Thanks for using our Amazon portal. I hope you forgive me for the crappy sound quality and that you could still enjoy that podcast. Much more coming this week and next week. Stay tuned. I love you. Hare Krishna.